This is perhaps not an avenue that's going to provide avalanches of good results, unfortunately. So we're led to consider more subtle computational benefits that quantum computing might provide, more subtle features of computation. And one such feature is the notion of parallelizability, even within the class of polynomial time algorithms. And this is something that's been very much studied in classical complexity theory. And in the quantum context, we'll see that, as Hans has already alluded to, measurement-based models provide an especially good framework for considering this kind of situation. Now, I want to begin by emphasizing that I'm not talking here about quantum parallelism, you know, the usual doing things in superposition, but rather just old-fashioned classical parallelism of doing classical or quantum operations in parallel at the same time. And even in the classical theory, you know, we have the class of polynomial time algorithms, which we can think of in terms of polynomial size circuits, and such a circuit can generally have polynomial depth. You have to do polynomially many gates in a row to get from input to output, but some problems are parallelizable in that although you still have polynomially many gates, the depth can be exponentially smaller. You only have sort of a logarithmic distance to go from input to output. You can do many parts of the computation at the same time and then combine their answers in a suitable way. And it's not known whether every polynomial time computation can be parallelized in this way. There are interesting cases where you can and other cases where it's believed you can't. So it's interesting to consider where, in the quantum context, whether quantum computing can provide any interesting benefits for this feature of algorithms. So let's move on to consider measurement-based models, and it's very fortunate that Hans has given a very nice introduction to the one-way quantum computer, so I won't need to really elaborate on that very much. I'll be talking mainly about teleportation-based quantum computing, which is based on the idea of gate teleportation of Gottesman and Chuang and developed by Nielsen, Jung, and others into a full computational model. And then we also have the one-way model of Rausendorf and Briegel, which we've just heard a lot about. And these two models have some common features and some distinguishing features. So in common, they both start with a large fixed entangled state of many qubits. In the case of the one-way quantum computer, we have the cluster state that we've been hearing about. But for teleportation, we can think of that as based on a grid of EPR pairs, or maximally entangled pairs, which are all sitting there ahead of time. So it's a much simpler kind of state. It only has bipartite entanglement, whereas the cluster state has this rather nebulous multi-entangled property. Well, these models, as Hans already mentioned, are polytime equivalent to the gate array model, which is very commonly used, the gate array model. So in other words, each can simulate the other completely with only polynomial overhead of resources. So you might think, why should we, you know, be perverse and introduce all of these weird structures when we can just happily carry on with gate arrays? But an important point I want to make here is that these equivalences become very non-trivial for these more subtle properties. Polynomial time equivalence of models preserves the class of polytime computations, which people often talk about, but it doesn't preserve other things, these more subtle features like parallelizability. And in fact, the situation is extreme as you could possibly have. Even in classical computation, you know, you have the one-tape Turing machine and the gate array model in the classical case. Well, they're well known to be polytime equivalent as computational models, and the gate array model has a notion of parallelizability, of doing gates at the same time, but the one-tape Turing machine model doesn't even have a natural notion of parallelizability at all to even try and map into. So this is a rather interesting, so therefore it's interesting to consider these alternative models from this point of view. And in these measurement-based models, given this sort of laid out entangled state at the start, we get this nice natural injection of parallelizability properties at the start, because measurements on different qubits always commute. They can be done in parallel on separate systems, unless you have this awkward adaptiveness that the choice of the measurement depends on the other one. But in principle, they can always be done in parallel. So a further feature of these measurement-based models, and this is something that goes beyond the classical notion of parallelizability, which I think is especially interesting, and Hans already alluded to this too, but let me just emphasize it, is you can adopt an attitude where, contrary to normal thinking, we view classical and quantum computation as different resources. We don't think of quantum computing as a kind of improved classical computation, and the classical one is a special case. So we think of a quantum algorithm as separated into a classical part and a quantum part, and we aim to minimize the quantum part. So in the gate array model, if you take that completely to heart, it's asking you to view an algorithm as an entirely quantum process. Every single step is a quantum process. And this seems rather silly. If you look at, for example, Shor's algorithm, you do your Fourier transforming and measurements and so on, and then you have the most interesting part of the algorithm. In fact, 90% of the interest of the algorithm is in the classical post-processing. It's this beautiful theory of continued fractions to get rational approximations and so on. And it's just absurd to regard that part of the algorithm as quantum. So we really should try and think of that as classical. So the upshot is we want to view a polynomial time quantum algorithm as a polytime classical algorithm, which is sort of punctuated by injecting results from a quantum process, a supplementary quantum process on the side. So we think of a quantum algorithm as an alternation of classical and quantum processes, where each one feeds into the other. You do some quantum stuff, and which involves some measurements, and that gives you some classical data. Then you do some classical computation with that, which feeds back into the quantum next section by choice of measurements or even gates. And you similarly alternate in this way. And we want to minimize the amount of quantum supplement that we want that we need to provide here, and yet still capture the full power of quantum polynomial time computation. So we want to minimize it in the sense that each quantum part should have very shallow depth. And between the quantum layers, when the classical computation is going on, we just hold the quantum state from the previous layer stationary and then use it again later on. So in the measurement-based models, to be more concrete about this, I'm thinking of the quantum part as being the measurements in these that can be done in parallel. And then the classical part is having done a layer of measurements, you do some computations, which are just bit sums in the one-way quantum computer, to compute the choice of basis for the next level. And then you do the next level and do some more classical computation and so on. So in this model, you can you have a natural conjecture that any polynomial time quantum algorithm, this is the only conjecture I should emphasize, can be done with log n quantum layers interspersed with polynomial-sized classical computation. And here I'm generalizing the measurement-based models to allow gates in the layers as well, whose choice can depend on previous measurement outcomes. So of course, you know, on the a priori, a general polytime quantum algorithm would require polynomial number of layers. So this is saying something about sort of an economy of quantum effort, which suffices to capture the full model. Well, I don't know how to prove that, but this line of sort of these ideas was stimulated or inspired very much by a very nice paper of Cleave and Watrow's some years ago, where as a corollary to their main results in that paper, they showed that in fact Shor's algorithm does indeed have this form, can be recast in this way. Okay, so that's kind of, you know, what we might ultimately aim to prove, a result of that sort. But I'm going to be much more modest here and consider much more restricted kinds of parallelizing and focus more on things that can be done really in just one quantum layer. So let me begin by saying more about these measurement-based models. And instead of the one-way quantum computer, I'm going to focus on teleportation quantum computing. because I think it's much simpler to think about, and as I'll explain in a little while, it suffices to completely understand the one-way quantum computer as well, in a rather nice way. So what is this teleportation model? Well, we've heard things about it, but let me give my version here. So you recall standard teleportation. Alice has her state at number one, and then 2, 3 is a maximally entangled state. We think of 3 as being over at Bob. And you know, we think that normally it's a Bell state, say this 0, 0 plus 1, 1 state. And then you perform a Bell measurement with outcome CD, and you get this Pauli corrected version of psi over at 3. And the Bell measurement is the usual Bell measurement I've written there. But in fact, if you can use any maximally entangled state you want at 2, 3, and you just have to adjust the Bell measurement to it. And the Bell measurement is always simply the 4 Pauli matrices, I, X, Y, and Z, applied to the left-hand half of whatever maximally entangled state you're using, and that will work to give this. Okay, but it's easy to show that. Now, in order to do computation, this idea of teleporting gates, we, instead of doing a standard Bell measurement of this sort, we do a so-called rotated Bell measurement. We simply take our Bell basis and apply U dagger, where U is a 1-qubit gate. We apply U dagger to the left-hand half as well, after all of these Paulis. And then we do that rotated measurement instead. And a simple calculation shows that instead of getting just the Pauli's times psi out at Bob's side, you get that, but psi gets transformed by the gate. So this is so-called teleporting the gate. The gate is applied by just measurement through this teleportation process. So given a whole reserve of these maximally entangled states, we can apply sequences of gates to any given input state by measurements alone, and we can generalize this to 2-qubit gates, which we need for universal computation, in many ways. The most obvious way is just to teleport in higher dimensions. For a 2-qubit gate, you teleport over 2 qubits. Instead of using a 2-qubit Bell measurement, it now becomes a 4-qubit Bell measurement, and that works perfectly well. But you know, one can be cleverer than that and devise methods which require measurements on fewer numbers of qubits, which I won't elaborate on here. Okay, so there are various things you can do. Now, in order to do universal computation, we want to implement arbitrary sequences of gates from some universal set. For example, the controlled phase gate, X rotations and Z rotations is a nice such set. But there's a slight catch here, which you've probably noticed already and we've seen in the previous talk, that, well, if you want to apply a sequence of gates, U1, U2, U3, when you successively teleport, you get this annoying property that you don't actually get the gate you want, but an extra Pauli comes attached to it, and the choice of the Pauli depends on the measurement outcome. So this is how the randomness of the measurement sort of feeds into this model. So we've got to find some way of dealing with this. And what we do is we choose our universal set in a way to behave in a nice way relative to Pauli operations. And so the way we sort of get rid of all these Paulis is this idea of adaptive measurements. And this is why this is what spoils the perfect parallelization of anything from the outset. So what we do is we choose universal gates like the ones I had, X and Z rotations, for example, which have nice commuting properties with Pauli operators. Of course, they don't commute exactly. So for example, X rotations obviously commute with the X Pauli, but if you pull a Z Pauli across an X rotation, well, the Z can come out the other side unchanged, but the angle of the rotation gets flipped to minus the angle. And similarly for the X Z rotations the other way around. So this leads to this idea of adaptive measurements. Suppose we want to do an X rotation on a state followed by a Z rotation. Well, if you do your first teleportation, you get your X rotation, but you get this Pauli expression here as well. And when we pull this Pauli through the next Z rotation. Well, the z doesn't bother it, but the x flips the sign of the angle beta. So you get beta going to minus 1 to beta. So if instead of doing the measurement corresponding to the beta z rotation, we instead do the measurement corresponding to the minus 1 to the power b times beta, then everything's okay, because when we pull this operator through, it just kills off the minus sign. So in other words, this second measurement, its choice is adapted to the outcome of the measurement of the first. It depends on the b, which is one of the measurement outcomes. So in this way, we can adapt all our measurement bases. And after we've applied a whole lot of such teleportations, we get the correct unitary that we wanted. and you get a whole lot of Pauli's stuck out the front, which you could then correct if you wanted to by, for example, just one cubic gates on all the separate qubits. But they tend not to cause a problem, for the purposes we use these states, so we just sort of leave them there, but we still have the state we wanted here. And this is the basic idea of teleportation computation. So this awkward feature of adaptiveness spoils the parallelizability, but some gates are special and behave particularly very, very nicely in this regard. And so just to emphasize again, if the choices of bases were not adaptive, then we could just do everything in parallel. And it's this Pauli propagation through the gates that caused the problem. We had to sort of change the gates to allow for this. But some operators are very special in this regard, and these are these Clifford operations, which have already been mentioned. And we have Clifford operations for any number of qubits. And they're defined in the following way. So we define the Pauli group on n qubits to be the group generated by the Pauli matrices on each qubit and tensor products of them, together with plus and minus signs and I factors. So for example, the 3-qubit Pauli group has expressions of this sort in it. And a Clifford operation is then simply defined to be any operation that conjugates the Pauli group to itself. So the Clifford group, if you like, mathematically, is the normalizer of the Pauli group in the full unitary group. So you get all these different ways of writing it. But perhaps, down to earth, and the most transparent thing to say is a Clifford operation has the property here that if you pull a Pauli operation across it, then the Clifford operation stays the same, but the Pauli operation can change. But when you perform this conjugation, you don't have the p's going to the same p, it just has to stay within the group. So the Pauli can change, but the Clifford stays the same. So, and it's known exactly what these things are in this particular case. There's Hadamard operation, controlled x, controlled phase, and so on, are all Clifford operations. of 1 and 2 qubits. And the theorem one can prove is that for a general number of qubits, n qubits, the Clifford group, complete characterization of such things, is all n qubit gates generated by these things here, the Z Pauli operator, the Hadamard, this pi over 4-phase gate, and the controlled X, or controlled not, same as controlled not operation. Okay, so coming back to this parallelizability, in the measurement model, if we wanted to apply a sequence of Clifford operations to n qubits, we can do all the measurements in parallel now, because what you get are these Cliffords interspersed with Paulis, and then noting what all the measurement outcomes are, you know what all the Paulis are, and you simply propagate them all out the front and get the Clifford Clifford operated state just in one quantum parallel layer. And also the starting state of many EPR pairs can also be made in constant depth, obviously. You just do them all simultaneously at the same time. But there's a slight catch here, is that although we have depth one process for the quantum measurements, we still have to compute these Pauli exponents here. So there's a bit of classical computation to be done on the side, which actually turns out to be just bitwise sums of these measurement outcomes, mod 2. So rather than reducing Clifford operations to a depth one quantum operation, what we've really achieved here is reduced Clifford operation on n qubits and represented it as a constant depth quantum part followed by a purely classical part, polynomial-sized computation. So this is an example of the sort of the conjecture I had at the start, a very simple example of it, where you only have one quantum layer. And indeed, it's known that any Clifford operation on n qubits, any gate array of that sort, can in fact be represented as a log depth gate array. And here we still have log depth, but the crucial bit here is this separation of, we've squashed the quantum part into constant depth, not log depth, and most of the depth is now just classical. This is a fundamental parallelizability feature of these models and this notion of Clifford operations. So before developing that a bit more, let me digress now to briefly consider the one-way quantum computer that we've just been hearing quite a lot about. So at first sight, it looks very different. And I think Hans liked to emphasize that it was different. But I want to emphasize that it's really, I would say, the same thing in a very real sense. So just to briefly summarize here, the cluster state, so here's sort of a thumbnail sketch of how this works again. You start with an array of plus states, 0 plus 1, you know, equal superposition. We apply the controlled Z operation to every nearest neighbor pair. And the state we get is this cluster state. So this can be produced in constant depth. All these operations commute. And we also have one-dimensional ones as well, which are often useful to consider for illustrating things. And then just to summarize some of its basic features that we've heard about in more detail just in the previous talk, any quantum circuit can be implemented as a pattern, a suitable pattern of one qubit measurements on a cluster state. And producing these patterns is a bit of a black magic art. If you read the papers, it's never explained where they come from. But I think this teleportation correspondence reveals systematic ways of generating them in a simple way. But anyhow, they certainly exist. And the measurements, you only do one qubit measurements, and the measurements are always either in the Z basis or these bases on the equator of the block sphere. So it's a simple one parameter family of these m theta basis measurements. And it's really these m thetas that drive the computation in the model. The Z basis measurements just serve to prune the shape of the thing you're working on because you don't often need, you know, exactly rectangular grid. So it's really these m thetas that do the work for you. The measurement outcomes are always 50-50 random, 0 or 1. And as in teleportation, as we've seen, quantum gates are implemented up to Pauli errors, which depend on the measurement outcomes, and these are the so-called byproduct operators in that literature. And that gives rise in exactly the same way to this feature of adapting your measurements. There are various different ways of relating teleportation quantum computing to the one-way quantum computing. There's at least three different ways that I know of. But here's my favorite way, which was given by Festrater and Chirac. In fact, it was the first way of relating them. But I think it lay unnoticed for a long time because the paper is almost impossible to read, being a very condensed PRL. So here we interpret each, at the end of the day, each one qubit measurement in the one-way quantum computer as a full teleportation. You see, one obvious difference between the models is that in teleportation, you don't have one qubit measurements. You have Bell measurements, which the simplest one is 2 qubit or even more for the bigger gates. So the basic idea is the following very beautiful observation, which is at the bottom of the whole thing. So let's consider not the Bell maximally entangled state, but this one I've called H, which is controlled Z of plus plus, which is a maximally entangled state that has the computational basis on one side and the Hadamard basis on the other side. Okay, and it's symmetric, it turns out, as well. So denote it by this double blob thing. And consider a grid of these states. So this great big grid state just falls apart, obviously. It's not multi-entangled. It's only bipartitely entangled. And so at each site that I've circled in green, consider a two-dimensional subspace spanned by all zeros and all ones. So for example, you know, one of these interior sites has four qubits, a 16-dimensional space sitting there. And inside that 16-dimensional space, there's a two-dimensional subspace of A all zeros plus B all ones. And consider the projector at each site that projects this grid state down onto that one qubit state at each site. So here I've written the projector, and I've relabeled this qubit as zero twiddle and one twiddle via this projector. So the question is then, what do you get when you project this state down to these qubits at each site? And you've probably already guessed, otherwise I wouldn't be saying it here, is you get precisely the cluster state of the one-way quantum computer. And so in other words, this complicated multi-entangled cluster state can be naturally viewed as sitting inside, lives inside this larger ambient grid state, which completely falls apart. It's just bipartite entangled links. Okay, perhaps I won't go through the proof. Actually, it's very, very simple if you only look at it the right way. So what do we do with this? So we can now use this fact to make a very close correspondence between the two models. So remember in teleportation quantum computing, we apply gates by teleporting. We have these rotated Bell measurements. So Bell, if you want to apply U1, U2, and then U3, we do this U1 Bell measurement, U2, and so on. And remember, the Bell basis is U dagger, where U is the thing we want to implement. And then we have the Pauli matrices, and this acts on the left-hand half of whatever maximally entangled state we're using. So here we're using this funny H state that I just described. Not one of the Bell states, and I've just changed my notation here slightly. The Pauli matrices are labeled by 0, 1, 2, and 3, and if the measurement outcome is A, you get the A-th Pauli times U on the input state. That's this teleporting the gate. So, in this formalism, let's just consider computing what the Bell basis is for this particular one qubit unitary. Which is not one that appears very often in the literature, but is probably the most fundamental thing here for these measurement-based models. So if we compute the A equals zero, the identity and the X Bell basis vectors, we find, after just a very short calculation, that those two are just 0, 0 plus or minus e to the I theta 1, 1. Which is, so here I've got a one-dimensional thing here. So these, in other words, these two Bell basis states lie in the projected subspace that I project this valence bond structure down to get the cluster state. Okay, so in other words, so at each circled node, these two Bell states lie in the one qubit pi projected subspace. And furthermore, the Bell measurement restricted to these two outcomes is precisely the m theta measurement on the cluster state. So in other words, you can think of the one-way quantum computer operation as actually being a teleportation quantum computation in this slightly larger arena where only the first two of the four Bell measurement outcomes occur. So, of course, in practice, that doesn't happen. But in theory, you can view it that way, and you can understand everything about the one-way quantum computer in terms of teleportations instead by this. And this is the main ingredient of the one-way model. Similarly, all the other computational details of it, including implementation of two-qubit gates and so on, can all be understood as descendants of teleportation constructions in this bigger grid state under this projection. Okay, so based on this idea, I feel sort of comfortable in thinking only about teleportation quantum computing and being secure in the fact that I'm not really missing out on anything that the one-way quantum computer might offer in addition. Okay, so now let's go back to this idea of parallelizing things. And we had this nice idea of Clifford operations. So I want to try and construct. So the aim now is to try and find further classes of quantum algorithms that can be parallelized. So I want to and the way we try and do this here is by generalizing the structure of these measurement-based models. Now, in the cluster state approach, it's rather difficult to think of how one might generalize that multi-qubit entangled state. But in the teleportation case, there are very nice and huge number of inequivalent ways of generalizing teleportation, which potentially lead to new kinds of parallelized algorithms. So for one thing, we can teleport in higher dimensions, not qubits, but qdits, as they're called. And we can generalize, we get many more exotic groups, not just the usual Pauli group for Bob's correction operations. They're just sort of generalized Paulis, if you like, subgroups of d-dimensional unitaries. And given any such generalized teleportation scheme, you can ask for its associated Clifford group, namely the normalizer of this group in the full group of unitaries. And furthermore, you'd ask for the normalizer on the 2-qdit level and even more qdits. So you take 2 copies of this thing and normalize it in U of the bigger space, 2D, sorry, D squared rather. So you have this. And well, it's obvious immediately that the Pauli group, this thing, this P group, is always part of this normalizer. That's sort of obvious. And in fact, it's always a normal subgroup of this thing, of this group. But on the 2-qdit level, it's also obvious that the swap operation is always there, and products of the 1-qdit Cliffords are always there. But we want more. So we want to try and get as much structure in here as we can, because these Clifford things are the things that we're going to be able to parallelize in a quantum computation based on a generalized measurement-based model based on this general notion of teleportation that we get. Okay, so how do we generalize teleportation? Well, we've seen in this conference some very beautiful and intriguing ways of representing teleportation in Samson Abramsky's talk. I thought that was particularly nice. But here's an algebraic way of doing it, which is extremely brief. So this is teleportation in any dimension D. So start with any maximally entangled state, which I write in it can always be written in its Schmidt form like that. So we'll just write it like that. So we haven't specialized to anything yet. And now we prove the following simple fact. If I take that maximally entangled state between 2 and 3, and I put a state alpha, a qdit state at 1. So I have this 3-qdit thing. And if I project, simply do a mathematical projection of 1, 2 here onto this state at positions 1 and 2, then what I'm left with at 3 is precisely alpha with the 1 over d here, because you've projected. Now, the proof of this is extremely simple. It's only one line if this slide was in landscape instead of portrait. So, you know, you just take this bra here, it's just this, you know, you just turn this the other way around. The alpha and the phi are just these things. And you just have I's hitting J's and K's, and they have to be forced to be equal. And it's a very trivial calculation to get that. And I would say that this simple one-line calculation embodies essentially everything about teleportation. And furthermore, a vast array of generalizations of it as well. Because, well, you attach the fact too, which is just an obvious thing, is that if you have an inner product, you can move a unitary from one side to the other side if you put a dagger on it. So if you have U dagger A inner product with B, that's A, and then the U dagger can be thought of as acting on the B with like that as a U. Okay, that's just an obvious thing. So now, instead of just taking this straightforward maximally entangled state, if I hit the number, the first bit of it, with a U1 dagger, and now perform this inner product, well, the U1 dagger can be thought of instead of as acting on the alpha by this thing. So fact one immediately tells me that if I take one of these U transformed states, then and perform this projection, I get U of alpha out at the other side. Okay, so that's that. So now what we want to do is we want to view this projection as a measurement component. Okay, we want to view these phi U's here as being the projections from a measurement. So in other words, I now want to choose families of unitaries, U, such that these phi U's are an orthonormal set. So for Q bits, you have 4 of them, and for Q dits, you have D squared of them. So, and each such choice will give me a way of teleporting where the U's turn into the Bob's Pauli's. You know, the U's are the Pauli's, if you like. So in dimension D, the condition that these states are orthonormal, it's obvious, you know, it's just a one-line calculation. It's just that the, you know, this Hilbert-Schmidt norm thing for the U's makes them into an orthonormal set. And then Bob's correction operators are just the U's. So for example, standard qubit teleportation, the U's are just the Pauli's, and teleportation is just as we know it. And we're interested ultimately in the Cliffords of this thing, the stabilizer of multiple copies of this group in this appropriate unitary group. And we know what it is. It's generated by all these things that we had before. And hence we can parallelize those. So now in dimension D, there is a natural way of generalizing this standard situation to a standard situation in dimension D. You introduce the X in D dimensions is the thing that bumps all the states up by one. So that actually does correspond in two dimensions to the usual X. And the D-dimensional Z operation just has powers of the D-th root of unity. That's just like the two-dimensional case. And one can prove fairly easily that, you know, the powers of the products of these two things, you know, Z, XCA, Z to the B, those D-squared operators, the so-called Weyl-Heisenberg group or something, has the required property. And in that case, we even know what the Clifford group is in D dimensions, at least for D prime. I think it's known for D generally too, but I don't really know what that is. But one can compute explicitly the following result, although it's quite difficult, I should say, in general, to find Clifford operations for general groups. But in this case, you can do it because you just generalize the qubit sort of calculation. So you introduce this general controlled X operation, but now the control has D different levels, not just 2 levels. So it's, but it controls by applying the J lots of X to the K. Okay, so that's how you generalize the control. And we introduce this funny phase thing. This is the generalization of the pi over 4 phase Clifford that we had before. It's this diagonal thing with exponentially growing, sorry, with quadratic sequence of indices on the dth root of unity. And you can guess, you can actually guess this to write down, because if you look at the proof of the qubit case, the Hadamard conjugates X into Z, and that funny phase operator there conjugates X into Y. So here we're looking for an operator that conjugates X into ZX, which is like the Y. and then you can easily derive that it should be this. So, but anyhow, then one can prove that for prime dimensions at least, the Clifford group on n qubits is generated by that generalized Z that we had, the Fourier transform in D dimensions, which is the Hadamard generalization, this phase operator and this controlled X. And hence, all circuits of gates of this sort in the suitable measurement-based model can be parallelized to depth 1. Okay, but this is only the standard situation. This is only one way of generalizing the basic qubit case. It turns out that there are vast numbers of other inequivalent ways of doing it. So there's a very nice paper of Werner where he discusses so-called shift and multiply bases. So we define D squared unitaries in D dimensions by this funny looking formula here. So I don't say so ij, so that's I and j label the d squared operators that we've got. Okay, I and j both go from 0 to d minus 1. K is the basis state. And their permutation, these unitaries are permutations with attached phases. And if you match up the ij and k in this funny way, these permutations here should form a Latin square. So in other words, it's a d by d square where every row and column contains each number exactly once. And these phases have to fit together to form a so-called complex Hadamard matrix, which is a matrix where every entry has modulus 1 and it's essentially unitary with once you rescale it by 1 over root d. So, and then you can prove that this prescription will generate a nice set of orthonormal operators for you, which you can use for teleportation. Now, there are vast numbers of examples of such things, and even this doesn't exhaust all the possible ways of doing it. Essentially, it's an unsolved mathematical problem, what all the operator bases are in that sense. So, as a special example, if you take the Latin square to be the addition group for integers mod d, and the Hadamard matrix to be the Fourier transform, which always works in any dimension here, you get the previous standard Pauli's that I mentioned for d dimensions. But there are many other choices. For 5 dimensions, Euler already identified 56 different Latin squares. For 10 dimensions, there are more than 10 to the 24th known. Full classification is unsolved. And there are plenty of Hadamard matrices as well. They exist in every dimension because the Fourier transform is one, so that's an existence proof. Real Hadamard matrices don't, but complex ones do. And for some dimensions, you even get parameter families of them, so you get uncountably many such things. So you get just a bewildering variety of inequivalent ways of teleporting out of this, and potential Clifford groups to go with them. So these d squared operators that you write down generally don't close to form a group. They're not that nice, not like the Pauli's, which just sort of close up very quickly to form a group, but they often generate quite large groups. So since in our model we want to accumulate, remember these Pauli's accumulate as we do more and more measurements, what we're really interested in is the group generated by these things. Well, so given such a great variety, you think you could generate lots of nice, interesting examples, but we haven't really been very successful in this regard. It's difficult to identify Clifford operations at the two-qubit level. And using computer algebra, you can express the Clifford condition as a set of linear equations and so on. And for small dimensions, the only ones we've found are just subsets of known Cliffords already, the standard ones. For larger dimensions, the group becomes too large to handle, even with, you know, using computer algebra and our inept ways of using that. So far, we haven't actually found any new Clifford operations using this immensely rich structure there. So this leads to a natural question is what structure, you know, can we tell by looking at the group whether we're going to get any interesting Cliffords? What structure should a group, a finite subgroup of unitary matrices have in order that it has interesting normalizers at the two level like this? Well, having been daunted by that for a while, we found a different approach. In addition to all those ways of teleporting, there are even more ways of teleporting, which is still completely different. And you can teleport in a way where you use POVMs instead of von Neumann measurements. So the Bell measurement need not be a von Neumann measurement. You can use POVMs there and get teleportation schemes, even for qubits, where Alice has to send more than 2 bits of classical information to finish the job. So remember, we had this maximally entangled state, and we modified it on one side with a unitary, and we tried to make these things orthonormal, like we wanted 4 of these things in the qubit case, like the Pauli's, to get an orthonormal set. Well, that's only for a projective measurement. We can ask more generally a larger set of operations such that this set of rank 1 positive operators, these projectors scaled by some positive constants, form a POVM instead. So we want this condition to hold now. We want u such that this condition holds for some choice of constants, and we have more than d squared of them now. So this is rank one POVM. And many examples of such things exist even for qubits, where the previous construction didn't really give you anything beyond the standard one, up to equivalence of certain sorts. So, and here's one way of seeing that there are many such things. Suppose you have a family of unitary matrices in d dimensions, which forms an irreducible representation of a group. In other words, it acts irreducibly on the d-dimensional space, and it closes to form a group. Then it's fairly easy to see that this condition holds with all the k's being equal. So the teleportation will give you constant probabilities for all the outputs. Even that doesn't always happen in more general situations. So the POVM condition holds with some fixed constant here. And it's easy to prove. You need Schur's lemma on one half to knock these u's down to the identity. And on the other half, we need to use the fact that phi was maximally entangled to get the identity on the second lot of d's there. So knowing that, we're sort of geared up to look for even more Clifford groups. And we can stay in small dimension as well, so we have a hope of keeping a handle on things. So even in dimension two, we represent q bits on the block sphere in the usual way, the surface of the sphere, and then unitaries are rotations of the sphere, SO3 rotations, and we're looking for finite groups of unitaries. So a natural thing is to look at the rotational symmetry groups of the platonic solids, which give you lots of nice finite subgroups of rotations. And so you indeed, by this method, get a teleportation scheme associated to each platonic solid. And this becomes even more exciting when you look at the cube group and realize that the symmetry group of the cube is actually the same group as the one qubit Cliffords for the standard qubit case. And the Paulis, the standard Paulis, are a normal subgroup of that Clifford thing, which are just the 180 degree rotations of the cube about the three axes. So this is very hopeful. It looks as though we're onto some nice geometrical connection here, but alas, it seems not to be, because when you move to the tetrahedral group, if you want to think of that as the Clifford group, then the Paulis should be a normal subgroup, and it's only got one proper normal subgroup. And you can compute that with computer algebra and figure out all of its Cliffords and everything, and you don't get anything interesting beyond what we already had. And if you try and use the whole tetrahedral group as your Pauli group, which you could do, you still don't get anything interesting on the two qubit level. And you might have expected that from the start, because the tetrahedral group is in fact a subgroup of the cubes group, so you might not expect any richer structure coming from this. Well, but then you take a deep breath and move on to the dodecahedron, and it's dual the icosahedron, but you're sort of knocked down at square one there, because its symmetry group is simple. It doesn't have any normal subgroups, so it can't be the Clifford group of anything. And if you try and use it as the Pauli group, then you still don't get anything interesting, because that means this group would have to live in a larger finite subgroup of rotations, but there's a full classification of finite subgroups of the rotation group, and they're either abelian cyclic groups, which are not of interest to us because they don't act irreducibly in any sense, dihedral groups, or one of these platonic solid groups. So we've sort of run out of steam on the qubit level here. And so we need, it seems, to go to higher dimensions to try and find interesting examples. But it's rather frustrating how the simple Pauli group that we know and love so much, that appears absolutely everywhere, has this amazingly rich structure in this regard, which seems rather difficult to reproduce in any nice generalization. So we have some ideas for how to construct bigger groups with interesting Cliffords, but I won't go into that here, but just finish with a list of open questions. I haven't really solved any problems here, but just raised these questions. I guess most fundamentally, how can you tell if a finite subgroup of unitaries has interesting normalizers on, say, the two qubit level? this is a well-defined group theoretic problem, and I think there probably is such a condition which one can eventually find, and then you don't have to go guessing around and trying to find Cliffords. You can just construct groups of the right sort. And we've seen, you know, as Hans mentioned, that Clifford operations can be done with one quantum measurement layer followed by some classical stuff. Well, what if you're allowed two measurement layers? Well, even in the standard one-way quantum computer, there is a known result here that any circuit of controlled knots and just X rotations, or controlled knots and just Z rotations, can be done in two layers, but they're not sort of universal either. And so it's interesting to get more such classes, or three layers, or constant number of layers. I guess that's complete. There's nothing known about that at all. And then hopefully we get more and more things. And then coming back to my conjecture from the beginning, is it true that all of quantum polynomial time can be represented in this way with only a logarithmic number of layers? Or you could even be bolder in this conjecture and have, say, a constant number of layers, perhaps. We don't know. But this seems like a reasonable conjecture with a hope of possibly being true. And at that point, I'd like to stop. Thank you. Sorry. Yeah, I think they are equivalent in that.
You found the models are equivalent. They may not be from that one. Why not run the question?
Well, I think this frustrator. Yeah, sorry, yeah. The depth complexity in a teleportation versus I think it's probably the same, I would think. I mean, I would think that explicit correspondence of Verstrater and Chirac can be used to, which will preserve the depth. Oh, no, I wasn't trying to scare you, but I was thinking more of the gate array model, you know. So I think the gate array model compared to the measurement models. So, you know, those models are rather more different, whereas these two measurement models I was suggesting are rather similar to each other in this regard, yeah. Oh, okay, sure. Oh, sure. Okay, yeah, okay. Yes, perhaps I stated my thing, you know, too strongly or not clearly enough. I'm not saying that the graph state is bipartite in any reasonable sense. I'm just saying that you can understand, you can think about what's happening there in this bipartite way. Okay. You mean if you have d-dimensional case of these valence bonds, and you project them, you get a d-dimensional version of the one-way quantum computer. Yes. Yeah. Well, each one can be used to understand the other. It depends which one you regard as your favorite for whatever purpose. I mean, this correspondence is only theoretical, I should emphasize. In experimental situations, it's, you know, there are obviously maybe natural ways of getting cluster states rather than, you know, bipartite grids of entangled pairs. So it's very significant there to have the two different pictures.